Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is the editor of IP Watchdog, a patent attorney, Gene Quinn. Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's good to be here with you.
It's great to have you on the show. Brian Chaffin introduced us and suggested that you would be a great guest, and I figured that out. So here you are, and welcome.
Yeah, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys. I know you guys write about Mac a lot. I'm a big Mac fan, all things Apple, and it's a pleasure to be here with you to talk about Mac and whatever, I suppose.
Yeah, because you're a patent attorney, and we talk a lot about Apple's kerfuffles with Samsung and other companies and software patents a lot. It's a pleasure to have your show on you on the show, and I'm looking forward to your insights.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to call what they have going on with Samsung and kerfuffle.
Maybe we'll have time to get to that at the end. So when we were talking before, you told me that you had an early interest in engineering, but you also had an interest in law, and you had a philosophy about how to deal with that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to high school. It was all boys, and I was taught by Christian Brothers. And this is obviously many, many years ago, back before it was probably in vogue to be in touch with your feelings and what you really wanted to do in life. But they had us take these tests to figure out what it is that we really wanted to do, what we liked to do, and what we might excel at. And I scored evenly on law and engineering. And I went and I spoke with the guidance counselor, who was Brother Peter. And I was looking really for any excuse not to go into engineering, really. And he told me that if you go pre-law, you'll never be an engineer. But if you go engineering, you could always go into law. And, you know, that made sense to me. And that's kind of, I guess, my philosophy of life is keeping your options open. Now, I mean, you know, not being afraid to strike when you need to strike to take advantage of an opportunity. But, you know, just don't close doors, I suppose.
So what did you finally decide to do about your engineering interest?
Well, I went to Rutgers University to be what I thought was going to be a chemical engineer until I took chemistry. And it wasn't so much chemistry. It was chemistry, too. Because at Rutgers, you got all your basic sciences out of the way before you declared your major within the engineering. And I did well in chemistry. And then we went away for, you know, the Christmas break, and I come back. And I did not get an A+, let's just say. But they assumed on day one that you knew absolutely everything that they had taught you in the first semester, which I did not. So Chem 2 was a real challenge for me, and I realized, you know, I probably need to think of a different avenue here. So I went into electrical engineering. I liked computers.
You didn't even get to organic chemistry, which is a showstopper for many.
No, I did not. Because, I mean, I did okay in Chem 2, but I knew that the downward trend was not going to support me. So I went into electrical engineering, and I did well. I mean, you know, I did well enough. I went when the class was of engineers when we first started was 800 people. I was ranked about 400. And then when we wound up graduating, the class was about 200. I was ranked about in the middle, you know. So I managed to work harder and harder and harder to stay right in the middle. So I tell people that I was never going to set the world on fire as an electrical engineer unless it was quite frankly going to be setting the world on fire as an electrical engineer.
Did you feel like you had to be near the top in the top 10% to even think about having a career? Because that isn't really, really true.
Well, yeah, you know, and actually at the time for me, it probably was true. Maybe not completely true, but I went into college when President Reagan was in office and the economy was booming and engineers were coming out making great money. And I graduated when the first President Bush was in office, and the economy was no longer booming. And, you know, the very top people were taking all the spots in grad school, you know, and then the very next layer were getting some offers. But if you were not in the top 20%, maybe 15%, you were really struggling to figure out what was next at that little snapshot in time. And, you know, I was kind of young. I went to college when I was 17, you know, and that's not like super young. I wasn't like a prodigy genius or anything, but I was a little young. And I was the first person in my family to go to college. So I'm figuring out a lot of this stuff on my own. And I had this desire to do law or interest in the law. And so I just decided, well, I don't want to go flip burgers for a while, and I can't go to grad school for engineering. And, you know, what I was going to look at was probably at best getting like a sales job in engineering, because those were the only things that were available at the time for people who weren't at the very top end, which I didn't want to do. So I went to law school, and
wait a second. You told me about this story where you were kind of wrestling with engineering, and you had an interesting meeting with a professor because you were having some doubts.
Yeah. You know, and that was early on when I was struggling with electrical engineering, and I really wanted to do it. And I was really, really trying to do it, and I liked it. You know, I really liked the subject matter, and I was Professor Mamone at Rutgers, and I got an A in our first exam, a B in our second exam, and a C in our third exam. And at Rutgers, all the engineering classes, you had three exams and a final. So I go to him after I get the grade on the third exam, and I say to him, you know, the trajectory here is not going real well. I kind of see where I'm headed. And I said, do I really have what it takes? You know, and he was honest. We all really liked him. He used to have this saying, there were two types of EEs. There were electrical engineers, and then there were people who were eventually economics. So I asked him, I was like, you know, do I really have what it takes here? And he gave me the talk that, paraphrasing Thomas Edison, about the 90% perspiration, 10% inspiration. And he really believed that I could do it. And I thought to myself, well, if he believes I can do it, then I'm gonna do it. And I did. And I got the degree, and I'm extremely happy I did it, because nothing I've accomplished professionally in the legal field would be possible without having been an electrical engineer. I couldn't be a patent attorney. I couldn't have succeeded like I have. I don't think have the life that I have. So I really owe an enormous debt of gratitude to him. And it's a friend of mine that I went to law school with who also went to Rutgers. We did not overlap. We didn't know each other there. But he reminded me recently, within the last month, I told him that story. And he said, you know, that Professor Mamone did not tell everybody that. So he said he must have seen something in you to really encourage you. So I suppose that when you have that kind of teacher who really goes that extra mile to say, you know, maybe a different line would be better for you. But then with the people who he sees that have the ability, he does encourage them, even if they're struggling. I think, you know, we those types of moments in our lives are pivotal.
They are. And even when an engineering professor tells you you've got what it takes to do engineering, if you decide to change your career, that stays with you. You know, you've got the right stuff to do anything.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing. When I went to law school, when I first moved in, first time in my life, I had my own apartment, and you got to get your electric and all those other things that go into that. You got to hook up your cable. And the cable, I couldn't get an appointment to hook up my cable for like 7 weeks or something until after I moved in, which was, I couldn't believe. But so I had all kinds of time to read and get ahead. And I was just fascinated in this quiet period where I didn't have clutter from TV or I didn't know a lot of people as I moved to a different state. that I could understand the law, you know, and in electrical engineering, I got it, but I would really struggle and read it over and over and over again and go to the library and take out all kinds of different books. And so I just gravitated to the law and I got it. And but what
you created new neural pathways, right? As Geordie LaForge would say.
Yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, the thing that what brought that to mind was when you said is I always had this in my mind that, you know, once I got to law and I started having some kind of an aptitude for it, was that if I could do electrical engineering, I certainly could do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought to myself that, and I think to this day, that engineering is just a great field of study, even if you're never going to use it afterwards, because it teaches you about deadlines, it teaches you about responsibility, it teaches you about teamwork, and you have to be dedicated. So it is great training ground.
Yes, it is. I had a similar experience in my life. I want to tell you, Gene, I took a really tough path in life, theoretical astrophysics, working on a PhD, and one of my professors one day said to me, John, you've got terrific physical insight. For those not familiar with that, that's a technical term in physics, which means that you're well connected to nature, your physics engine works, and you have gut instincts that serve you well about how nature works. And to have that is profound, because you don't get anywhere in physics unless you have that. So that can light up your day. One instance, one comment, one remark from a professor, just like what happened to you, can change your life.
That's right. I mean, it really does. And like I said, I did not realize that he was paraphrasing the Thomas Edison quote about, you know, 90% inspiration and 10% perspiration. But, you know, not that matters, but that philosophy has always, from that moment, really carried through my life. And I think when I've taught and students, I've always tried to tell them, look, if you can read, you can learn. And if you are dedicated and you willing to do things, you can move forward. And when I've been a teacher, you know, there's these people that, let me just say, you know, like I've taught in law schools for a while and I teach a patent bar review course for aspiring patent attorneys and so forth. And it is never a shock when you see the students that have job offers and prospects versus the ones who don't. Because the ones who do go out of their way to put themselves in positions, they work harder, they show up at networking events, they take on extra responsibilities, they do everything that they're supposed to do and everything that you recommend. And then the ones who don't go those extra miles. And it all comes back, I think, to the 90% perspiration. Mm-hmm. If you are willing to put in the work, you can succeed in life.
The other thing that happens is that when a professor does say that they believe in you and they mentor you and they take you under your wings, it creates in your mind a very gracious, respectful, give back approach, so that when you become a teacher and a professor, you always remember how you were treated, and that it affects how you nurture and mentor your own students.
Yeah, and I think that is very true. And sometimes it's and this is probably true for parenting too. You know, it's sometimes the small comment or the inadvertent or accidental interaction that may have the biggest impact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big responsibility, but it's just the way that it is, you know. So you have to consciously try and remember that. And I do. And, you know, I'm not saying I succeed at all times, but it is a humbling experience when somebody will tell you how you've impacted their life, you know. And
it is.
So
you felt like you had a grasp of the law. It's something you wanted to embrace. You moved into it. You went on to get a master's degree, is that right?
Yeah, master's of law. And
is that different than law school?
Yeah, that's an extra year, or in my case, it was an extra 18 months because I wrote a thesis. And so the law degree is a JD, that's 3 years, or if you do it part-time, it's 4 years. And then there's an additional study of a year to a year and a half that you do in a specialized area. that you can get a master's of law in. And I did it in intellectual property.
Can I ask you how you financed that? Because long graduate school durations are often a financial challenge.
Yeah, well, I financed law school by loans, largely. You know, I worked jobs here and there for spending money, but law school was financed completely with loans. I still am making those loan payments. Mm. And then I got a job as I was doing litigation, general litigation. And then I went back and I got a full scholarship for my master's and a stipend. I was a graduate teaching fellow. So I did some teaching for a little bit of money, and I still worked part-time doing some research for the lawyers at the firm where I was at initially. So like many grad students, that last year and a half was going to school, writing my thesis, working, rinse, repeat.
Well, I want to talk to you more about this. I have a couple questions for you about law school. But first, I want to do a quick ad here, folks. We're going to take a short break. We will be back in 60 seconds with Gene Quince. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with Gene Quinn, patent attorney. So when you first started thinking about being an attorney, did you have some sort of vision or drive that you wanted to do something special, either prosecution or defense or patents or business law or something? Was that on your mind at this point?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're an engineer and you go to law school, you're thinking about patent law to start with. And I go to law school and I did really well my first year. And then you're looking for jobs during the summer and so forth. And you're sending out resumes and looking for job openings. And I found that all these job openings wanted your undergraduate grades, you know, and I was going to law school to escape that. So I thought to myself, and again, remember, when I went to law school, I was 21 years old. I was pretty young, doing this all on my own. And I had mentors. And with this, I wish I had asked somebody, maybe things would have been different, because I just assumed that, well, I'm never going to get any of these jobs. If they're looking for top 20% or 25% of your engineering school, I have top 10% of law school, but I'm never going to do this. So that's why I decided to just do litigation, just general litigation. And then, you know, you come to grow up and you find out, well, when somebody's posting a job, that's the ideal candidate. But how often does the ideal candidate ever really walk in the door? So I got scared off of patent law and I did just general litigation, which in retrospect probably was great, because I learned a lot of different areas of law and I learned a lot of different skills that as a patent litigator, you wouldn't have learned for years, because patent litigation is you work on two or three cases a year, maybe, where I was in court all the time, arguing motions and filing stuff. And so it was an interesting time and I really enjoyed it.
So here comes the jackpot question now. So you're in law school, you're in litigation, and you're using a computer, and because it's law, you're using a Windows PC by necessity. Not true, right?
Well, that's funny. You know, when I was in law school, I used an Apple. I used the Mac. Mm-hmm. And then when I got a job at a law firm, I went and I did go over to PC, just because that was what everybody was using. You know, that was what the firm used. That was whatever. That's what all the business software was really run on PCs. That's how, if you wanted to do work in the business world, you had to use a PC, really.
I went through that phase when I was younger. I was informally trying to promote Macintoshes at work because I was an Apple resource coordinator, and I was running across this kind of problem where every time you turned around, it was the serious stuff, the business stuff, the law stuff. And we all in the Apple community, we were just kind of like frustrated, you know. Why can't this superior platform be the favored machine? It's just a better system. And we were frustrated that attorneys and businessmen, you know, just turned their backs on the Mac. It was frustrating.
Yeah, it really did. And so then I started just using a PC. And I think I may have mentioned to you previously, but, you know, I then became a committed PC user. And, you know, you get buy all in, you know, and then the longer you're using it, the harder it is to switch. So I lasted.
Oh, the Stockholm syndrome, right?
Well, no kidding. I mean, because I lasted all the way through Vista, and you know, and I think it was you the other day we were chatting, right? You made fun of me for lasting through XP, right?
you survived.
You know, the funny thing was, is, oh my God, we longed to go backwards to XP. Because Vista, I used to say, the V stood for virus. I mean, it was just terrible. So I lasted. I'm like, okay. So then they come out with, I think it was 7 came out after that. And, well, it can't be any worse. And then when 7 came out and you installed it on your machine, you essentially just installed it over Vista. So it still had all the weirdness of Vista with some of the weirdness of 7. I'm like, I just can't do it anymore because I was being unproductive. I mean, it's just your days are unproductive because I am a hardcore user from the minute I sit down to the minute I leave, I'm on my computer. It's just, it is, you know. So when the computer freezes or crashes or you get a virus or whatever, it really just makes your whole day unproductive. So by then, it had gotten, this cost of switching had gotten so much easier because there's now Word for Apple, and cross platforms are easy to use.
Right, and binary compatible across Windows and Mac. That was a big shift.
It was a big shift, and it made switching so much easier. And just knowing that when you sat down and you turned the machine on, it was going to actually work.
So what year was this? What was your phase of switching into the Mac world?
You know, I can't tell you for sure. It's within the last 8 years, because it's probably about 7 years ago, I think.
Okay, so this was in the era of perhaps Snow Leopard, which was an amazing operating system. That was a good place to come in.
Yeah. So it was a good time to come in. And but, you know, I'll tell you how committed I was to when I go all in, I go all in. And you're going to understand it with this comment. I even bought the Zune. Do you remember the Zune?
It rings a bell. Tell me more.
It was Microsoft's poor attempt at an iPod.
Oh, yeah, the Zune. The chocolate, the square brown piece of brick. Ish thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, quick. Yeah, the brown block.
It gets worse. Wait, it gets worse. I didn't buy one, I bought three. Because I bought one for me, I bought one for my son, and I bought one for my...
I remember it was, I think it was one of the popular Mac websites, put one in a toilet bowl and took a photo of it as a turd.
That's what it was. I mean, you know, okay, now here's the reason, right? You know, and everybody knows why you would do that. I mean, if you're doing PC, what you want, all you want is the stuff to work.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to be compatible. You want it to plug and play. And when you have something over here, it goes over there, you know, and it's Hakuna Matata, right? You know, and it never seemed like it was working out the way that it was advertised. So that's why I ultimately switched.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who did that along with you because Apple was building this great infrastructure. iTunes was the, well, you had the Mac as the digital hub, and you would plug your camera into it. You'd plug your iPod into it. You would download your music to your iPod. It was just this great, comfortable ecosystem that worked, and it was simple and reliable. Yep. And Apple sold a lot of iPods as a result of that.
Yeah. So, you know, now I wonder, I mean, you know, and this maybe it goes beyond what we want to talk about, or we need to talk about this another day, but I wonder whether Apple is going to stay that way now without Steve Jobs. I mean, he was, I don't know. So we'll have to see, but I am all in Apple. I have a desktop. I have a MacBook Air for when I travel. I have an iPhone and I have an iPad. So like I say, when I go all in, I am all in.
Well, you have good hardware and you have a good system and you should be productive with it. You know, there's some political overtones. There's some things that annoy us that we write about that Apple messes up from time to time. But, you know, when you look at the basic hardware, these MacBook Airs and MacBook Pros and iPhones, they're generally pretty delightful equipment.
Right, and they actually let you take them on an airplane because they don't because they don't blow up.
Right. Well, I want to jump forward now to what you're doing now. Right. You told me before that you were working with startups.
Yes.
How does that go?
Well, what generally, because most of what I do in the patent realm deals with software, and what typically happens is the type of person that, probably first thing to be said is there's no cheap, easy way to protect software with a patent. So this is not like somebody in their garage has come up with an idea and, you know, they've got no money and they want to move forward anyway. So they're looking to do it on a shoestring budget. Shoestring budget when you're dealing with software is all relative because, I mean, there's just so much that needs to happen that it's not the same as if you had invented like a kitchen gadget.
Are there still a lot of individuals or pairs of people who think they can start up a software company and compete with 1.5 million iOS apps and start from scratch and get rich? Are there people like that still out there?
Yes and no.
Okay.
There is certainly no shortage of people who are trying. And I don't see the ones who would be thinking that, well, they're going to be the next Google or Facebook or, you know, insert big, huge Silicon Valley name here.
GAFA.
You know, what they have is they have something that's interesting, something that they want to move forward with. Usually the type of person that I work with is somebody who is on some level in the industry already. Maybe they're a software engineer and they've done some inventing for a company and now they want to do it on their own for themselves. So they're familiar with what it takes and they're going to try and build something and grow up. Now I get contacted by people who probably fit your description, like they've got to come up with this app and then it's going to probably more like they're going to be the next Angry Birds. You know, it's going to be ginormous. Everybody's going to download it, blah, blah, blah. But that type of person is not usually the one I wind up working with because with the software patent, it takes so long to get it that if you're really doing an app for a phone or something small, the patent path may not be the right path for you because by the time you would get protection, you're probably on to what's next anyway. So in the software world, you're really looking to protect platforms. So if you're going to build off of a platform, that's when you're probably thinking about software protection.
Have you ever had any second thoughts about the respectability of software patents? Because the idea of a patent has shifted over the years, I think. I mean, patents used to be some ingenious invention like a perpetual motion machine or something that, you know, nobody had ever thought of before, and this is great. Like instant photography, I've got this camera idea where you can just, you know, plop this thing in, and then out comes the photo, zoink. But nowadays, people are patenting software. Tell me about your thoughts on that. Do you believe that that's a valid, workable, ongoing, enduring, positive thing to do?
Yeah, I do. And I think the problem becomes that we have a one single word, software, to describe everything from a simple counter app that you might have on your phone, you know, like if you're doing laps at the gym. And that will be a piece of software, quote unquote. And all the way up to describing what IBM is doing with Watson, you know, and using Watson to try and interject artificial intelligence to try and make diagnoses of certain cancers more predictable and earlier, you know, and then they leverage software to do that. And so obviously those two things are at totally different ends of the spectrum in terms of complexity. Mm-hmm. So, and the law hasn't figured that out yet, that on one end, it's, you know, it's sort of trivial, and on the other end, it's anything but trivial. So what I always tell people that I try and work with is like, look, where the patentability for software is going to reside is along the lines of where Murphy's Law is going to interact. And, you know, Murphy's Law, it's anything that can go wrong is going to go wrong. Mm-hmm. So if you have a piece of software that goes from A to B to C, and nothing is ever going to go wrong with this, and no human can ever screw it up, then you don't have anything that's really going to be protectable, because it's trivial. It is just linear, and it's either not going to be patent eligible or it's going to be obvious. But if you have something that has to take into account some kind of complex calculations and a human element, then you have an innovation.
So the brilliance is grasping with complexity to achieve a goal, and inherent in the complexity is the possibility of failure and success.
Absolutely. Like, let me give you a for instance. Like, what I always say is the people who think software shouldn't be patentable because it's so easy. What I say is, well, then obviously you've never used a computer before. And they get, you know, obviously indignant right away. Well, I'm a computer expert. Well, you're not a very good one. Because if you were actually ever using a computer, you would know that about once a week at a minimum, whatever platform you're using, you get a warning message that says, download this critical update. Okay, well, if software was so easy to do and get it right the first time, why do you have to weekly download critical updates?
Well, there's a whole field of study on that about writing secure code, and there's different languages that support structures that keep you from writing insecure code. That's a whole nother show.
Oh, no, it is. But what I'm saying is, and it's not to like point fingers at the programmers or what, they didn't do their job right the first time. But this stuff, it's very complex.
And there's also time pressure, too.
Time pressure, and don't forget, no matter wherever there's money to be made, wherever there's information to be had, you're going to have a lot of people trying to get at it for nefarious reasons. Mm-hmm. So a lot of critical updates are to plug holes, and a lot of those holes are not created so much by the original software, but by the ways that the software has been updated or used, or things that you've downloaded in your machine that are exploiting problems and so forth.
Right.
So this constant kind of dynamic universe. So in that kind of dynamic universe, what you're trying to do is not something that is incredibly easy to do on the high-end level.
And that's where you come in to help the developer patent those complexities and the uniqueness of their solution.
Right. That's right.
Cool.
Hopefully. Yeah, I mean, because the big problem with software, I think, is the more ubiquitous it gets, the more times people think that, well, maybe it shouldn't be protected. But the patent system is about trying to find things that are so useful that they become ubiquitous.
Interesting. So in your career profile, we just have a few minutes left, so I want to kind of start to wrap things up. So right now, you work with startups who need a patent attorney. You also do teaching.
Yep.
I think you told me you have a small business that you work on, too.
Yeah, well, actually, it's become the big business for me is IP Watchdog is a blog. And we started it back in 1999, just putting writings of mine up. And then back when the 08 collapse happened, I lost a bunch of clients like everybody did. No, everybody retreated. And I had this and I just started writing more and more and putting full-time energy into it and figured that, well, the more I write, the more people will know me and I'll get more work out of it. And then that just started to become its own little mini publication that is now a standalone entity. And
is that something people subscribe to?
No. Well, yes and no. I mean, you can subscribe and get the, but it's free. Everything we do is free. It's sponsor supported. And I do get, you know, people read what I write and they occasionally want me to represent them. So I get some legal work out of it that way. But it's been a real fun endeavor. So that's cool. The big for me.
Well, that's quite a story. That's quite a story. How you followed your vision and worked on your plans and was inspired by professors and teachers and found your love and then filled out your portfolio. That's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
No problem. It's been a fun ride. I just, you know, the best laid plans. People say, well, I would like to do what and I say, no, you don't want to do what I'm doing. Because it's been a strange path, but you know, the best laid plans are ones that take you to where you want, where you ultimately are going to succeed. It's working hard and then taking opportunities as they present themselves and just going for what's there.
That's great advice. Great advice. Oh, thank you so much, Gene, for being on the show. This has been an instructive and compelling story. It was great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate it.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Well, the best way to do it, if you go to ipwatchdog.com, right at the top, there's a contact button there. You can use that to get a message to me. And I say that's best because then that message will come to me and my staff. So when I'm traveling, they will be sure to get it to me. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. That's another great way to connect with me. So please find me that way.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks again. And thank you, listeners. Thank you so much for listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We will see you next time.